Now, when we say, are they real? Gosh, you know, near-death experiences are wonderful. You know, they challenge our whole concepts of what is real. You know, that's the first thing I've learned about near-death experiences is not really what is real, but I've learned that I don't think we have a good understanding of, you know, what is this thing that we call reality. And certainly near-death experiences muddy the waters quite a bit. But I think there's two issues involved. The first issue is, are these people making it up? I know there's people in the audience here that have had this experience. Bear with me. I'm not saying you're making it up. I'm just saying that's the first thing that comes to people's mind. Are they making it up? You know, do they want to be on talk shows? Do they want to impress their... Or are they gullible children that their parents pump them full of, you know, ideas? Are they religious zealots? Do they have, an axe to grind? So that's the first question is, are they making this up? And then the second question is this in fact a glimpse of life after death? Now, when I first heard this experience, I decided I would do my own study to see whether in fact these experiences are the product of overactive imaginations. Are they caused by drugs? Are they caused by high fevers, as Jamie assumed her experience was? Are they some artifact of resuscitation? And the charge I was given was to assume that you all have probably read our books. I don't want to dwell on this too much, but I do want to just, I'm kind of proud of the study that we did up at Children's, and I think it's unique. So I'm just going to tell you that when I was at Seattle Children's Hospital, to me, with the head of the Department of Neurology, the head of the Department of Anesthesiology, and other psychiatrists and social workers designed our own study to answer this question. We did not permit volunteers into our study. We didn't go out to people and say, hey, have you had a wacky experience to tell us about? No, we did something much more clean cut and pure. We systematically interviewed every survivor of cardiac arrest at Seattle Children's Hospital over a 15-year period. So we went to them, we found these people. I remember I told you earlier, it is really rare to survive a cardiac arrest. That's, if your heart stops beating, that's bad. It's not like on TV where they're all being resuscitated. You know, that's by and large, is a cultural myth. We only found 15, and we searched, through hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of charts. We then took those 15 children, and we compared them to over 160 children who were the same ages, the same sex, the same religious background, treated with the same medications, and most importantly, also thought they were going to die, had really scary and bad diseases which they thought they were going to die from. But none of these 160 children were truly near death. And what we found, it was completely in harmony with what Raymond Moody had discovered before us, and that was, of the 15 children that we looked at who survived cardiac arrest, most of them had not only a near-death experience, but had the same experience that adults had described. In other words, they said, wow, it was really weird. I thought I was floating out of my body. And it was all dark. And then I saw a light. And there was a lot of good things in that light. That's the typical kind of thing that a child would say. I want to give you the flavor of how they said it. I would go to their home. I interviewed them. The average interview lasted about 2 hours. They did not greet me at the door and say, hi, Dr. Morse, I want to tell you about my weird experience. Usually they hadn't even told their parents about these experiences. Remember, these are patients that we identified as surviving cardiac arrests. So we went to them, and we didn't even say we are near-death researchers. We just said we are interested in the long-term psychological effects of surviving a critical illness. You know, with a title like that, believing they were not expecting that, we were some kind of wacky near-death researchers. And, after a while, it was like I would go with medical students, too. And it was amazing because we almost could predict when the child would tell us of the experience. It was invariably at the end of the interview, after an hour and a half of hearing what the nurses were like and hearing what the hospital was like, we would turn off the tape recorder, We would get up to go, we'd put on our coat, and then, and boy, it was just, I mean, it was almost like we could just snap our fingers, and the child would say, you know, it's just one other thing. This was really weird, but I could have sworn I was floating out of my body, but nah, it couldn't have really been true. See, so they themselves asked this question, is it real? We then went to the 160 other children, children who by all rights should have thought they were going to die. And if cultural conditioning causes these experiences, or if these experiences are caused by hallucinations from drugs, etc., then these children should have told us the same thing. Many children in this group thought they had died. And yet, those children told us what I was taught to believe happens with critically ill patients. And that is, in fact, they say, I can't remember anything about the time I was unconscious. And that's the fascinating thing to me about near-death experiences as well, is that comatose patients are having these kinds of experiences. People have said to me, well, aren't they just dreams? A dream is something that happens to a healthy person when they sleep at night. Comatose patients are not supposed to be thinking. They're not supposed to be feeling or having any kind of psychological experience. And yet, the critically ill children, the ones who are truly at the brink of death, all said the same thing. And what was beautiful about children is rarely were the experiences religious. They usually spoke of a beautiful light. One boy said to me, there was a lot of good things in that light. Another girl said to me, I learned something. You know, I asked her, what's it like to be in the hospital? Well, I learned something from it. I said, well, what did you learn? Well, I learned that light is for living. And later, I can see it again. And what she meant by this was that this light illuminated her whole life. She claimed that she still saw the light at all times. She said, I see sparkles of it everywhere. So it's this light that to me is the most salient aspect of the near-death experience. So my first study satisfied to me that near-death experiences are real in the sense that they really happen to people, that they're not attention seekers, that they don't have some axe to grind. Most of the children never mention these experiences to their parents. These experiences clearly are not caused by drugs. They're not hallucinations. They are a unique event which happens to people when they die. And after studying these experiences for 5 or 6 years, I concluded that these are a normal and natural event. That the process of dying is not just simply going into darkness. There is a darkness. There's no question about that. They all tell me that there's a darkness. But then after that darkness, they say, comes a warm and loving light. A light that it is a love that they have never felt on this earth. And then frequently these children say that they decided on their own to return to their bodies. Now, whether these experiences are real in the sense of are they glimpses of life after death, I can't comment on that. I really can't. I'm a pediatrician, and I don't perceive these as after-death experiences. I heard one of these Zen stories once, in which the disciples came to the master and they said, "Oh, master, tell us what is it like, life after death." And the Zen master says, "Well, I don't know. Why are you asking me?" And the disciple says, but you're the Zen master. You know, who would know if you don't know? And the Zen master says, well, that's true. I am very wise, but I'm not a dead Zen master. And I think that's true about near-death experiences. These are not after-death experiences. These are not people who have died and been resuscitated. But at least I feel that the first step in my research has been to answer this question that I think everybody kind of asks, maybe not openly, but you know, are they, you know, at least I can say they are a normal event which happens to people when they die. Now, many people feel that these experiences are a retrospective fabrication. Oh gosh, what's that mean? Well, that means that, you know, what they're saying is that these experiences, sure, they happen to critically ill patients, but that as time goes by, the person is in a sensory-deprived state, they're in a very helpless state, they're like a little, you know, they regress to an infantile state, and they just kind of imagine, given the stresses of their illness, they sort of invent this on a subconscious level. There is actually a very good evidence about this. Dr. Schnaper at the University of Maryland did a wonderful study of people who had experienced severe trauma, and he actually filmed them while they were in the intensive care unit. And they were raving about all kinds of things. They were saying they were in heaven, they were saying they were in hell, they were saying people were tying them down, that people were sticking needles in them, that demons were attacking them. And what someone like Dr. Schnaper would say is that then after the trauma of the experience is over, the person forgets all the hellish parts and they forget all the paranoid fantasies and they reorganize the event into this culturally acceptable near-death experience. And I think that that's what most psychiatrists think. You know, if you have to pin psychiatrists down, I think we've sort of moved the medical profession to the point where they're able to say, well, yes, maybe people really have this experience, but it's some kind of psychological event. So that's what my next study is about. If this is in fact a psychological event, then I would expect that I would not necessarily be able to document the transformation that these, well, I study only children, you know, that these children tell me that they have. And what I'm studying now are adults who have had this experience as a child. And we give them a very sophisticated battery of psychological tests and such as that. And we answered the question that Dr. Moody raised earlier. We looked at children who had critical illnesses and yet had no near-death experience. And we compared them to children who had the near-death experience and looked at their psychological profiles. Because I think this is, you know, this is then the second issue that comes up. People say, sure, maybe they have them, but people who have near-death experiences are some kind of, it's only some kind of a personality type that has this experience. Maybe they're hysterical, maybe they're kind of too much into the new age, maybe they already are sort of mystical or, you know, have a lot of spiritual feelings anyway. I wish that they could meet the most remarkable man I've studied in my study so far. He's 87 years old, and I met him because we were planning on doing a tonsillectomy on his grandson. He's an old, crusty guy who served in both World War I and in World War II as a sergeant. And I'm explaining to his mother, I mean, not to my patient's mother, I'm explaining to them, you know, what it's like to have a tonsillectomy and what the side effects are and what they can expect in the hospital. And the old guy's in the corner, and I'm not really even thinking he's listening. And I really almost thought I heard him snoring. And then suddenly he pipes up and he goes, "Well, you didn't tell him about the tunnel." And I was like, "The tunnel?" You know? He said, "Yeah, I had my tonsils out and I went in the tunnel." And he didn't identify this as a near-death experience. This guy is as far from, you know, from a New Age spiritualist, Shirley MacLaine devotee, as you can imagine. And what I loved about him for my study is that he did not perceive that he had a near-death experience. He honestly thought that this was something involved with having your tonsils out. And even his daughter was like shushing him. He's like, Grandpa, don't go into that anymore. You know, because, you know, shh, you know, listen to what the doctor's saying. And meanwhile, all I wanted to hear was more about the tunnel. And he told me that when he had his tonsils out, he said, yeah, I got sucked into a tunnel. And it was like a seashell. And I went round and round and round until I came out in a beautiful light. And then I woke up and my tonsils were out. Well, I went back to his records. He's from Concrete, Washington. And they did his surgery back when they did the drop ether. And as you can imagine, there's many anesthetic reactions in those days. And there's no question in his chart that for about 10 minutes, his blood pressure was 50 over 20, that his heart rate had dropped down below 20, and that he was given a variety of medications that we typically use for cardiac resuscitation. And there's no question in my mind after reviewing his chart that he in fact had an intraoperative cardiac arrest. And it was not unusual to me at all that this would not have been either told to him or his parents or etc. And yet, when we did our little, you know, it's this humongous profile, but, you know, when we did that on him, we found that he had all the same characteristic features that we have seen in people who've had near-death experiences. He had no fear of death, none whatsoever. His values were very different than, and I'm going to bet it's very different than most master sergeants who are, you know, in their 70s and 80s. The way he perceived life, what he thought was important, he didn't put any emphasis on material values, but he was an intense spiritual person, even though he did not practice any religion or even believed in God. And yet, when you ask him these kinds of questions on psychological profiles, he had more in common with a lot of so-called spiritual people than I think that he would ever have known. And this is what we found again and again and again. And we have even identified a number of very specific physical attributes that we have found that I believe is part of this transformation. Now, how could that be? I have a friend whose dad died of lung cancer. My friend is a heavy smoker. He says he was transformed by that experience, threw his cigarettes away. And yet when I look at him and look at his lifestyle, I don't see any real transformation. And we have all had that experience, I think, of something shocking happening to us, or the people in my study who have come to the brink of death but didn't have a near-death experience, far from being transformed, they frequently have post-traumatic stress syndromes. There is no post-traumatic stress syndrome after people have had near-death experiences. What could possibly cause this? What I found was that near-death experiences, I believe, are caused by an area in the brain, in our temporal lobes. And I think that this has been well known for over 50 years. I believe there's an actual area in our brain which generates these experiences. And that this area of the brain is responsible for causing the experience and causing the resultant transformation. Now, does that mean that I don't believe the experience is real? Not at all. I'm certainly open to that perhaps this area of the brain is some kind of transmitter, that this light may in fact come from an area outside our bodies. Certainly the sequence of events is very suggestive, because when you think about the tunnel is almost certainly the collapse of the visual fields as the person is dying. The sense of being out of the body, that's a well-known phenomenon that anybody who's been in a traffic accident has seen some part of. You know, when you're in an accident, you sort of have a sense that you're kind of distant from your body, and you almost can see yourself moving automatically. And anyone who's, you know, you had a skiing accident or something like that, I think has had that sensation of being out of the body. Or some people have it just when they're falling asleep at night. So clearly that sense of being out of the body is a normal event. And then darkness, sure, that's what I was always taught in medical school. That's what happens to you when you die. And yet then comes this light. And I can't tell you whether this light comes from outside the body or whether it's generated inside the body. And as a pediatrician, I'm not terribly interested in that. What I would like to challenge you all today is to recognize that these experiences are in fact real experiences to the person who is having them. And I don't believe that any number of medical studies are going to go further than that. And yet, just that fact alone, that dying people are having amazing spiritual experiences, I think has the power to transform our society. Because I think that our society has a denial of death. And when I work in the hospital and work with dying patients, I'm very struck by this. The typical intensive care unit does not even have a place to sit down and talk with family or friends or family members about death and dying. In fact, we don't even talk to patients, by and large, about the process of dying. So it certainly is no surprise to me that my patients have never told their doctors or nurses that they had near-death experiences. I can't tell you how many conversations I've had in hallways discussing a grim prognosis. How many times there isn't even a private and comforting place to discuss these kinds of issues with family and friends. I can't tell you how many families I've seen in chaos because of the unexpected death of a child. And the child, before they die, is saying, to the moon, I'm going on a rocket ship to the moon. And the parents, in that particular case, did not recognize that the child was having a spiritual experience that they could learn from. I had always assumed that comatose patients couldn't hear anything. And yet, my patients tell me they hear everything when they're comatose. I have a close friend whose father died. And, you know, people don't just die anymore. They're usually hooked up to life support machines for a period of time and then, you know, disconnected from those machines. And he wondered whether his father could hear him when he was comatose. He's pouring his heart out to his dad, telling him he loved him. His dad's a physician, he's a physician. You know, we don't talk about love very easily. I'm astonished to hear women talking about love so openly. That's not a word I heard too much in medical school, that's for sure. And I think that we all have this, you know, particularly physicians have this role. And then he's noticing every time he told his father he loved him, that his comatose father's blood pressure changed. Now he's making an experiment of it, the way, you know, a doctor would, and he's getting the nurses in there. Do you really see it? Do you really see it? And then he asked me that question. He said, "Now, do you think my dad could hear?" I don't feel I can tell you that near-death experiences are proof of life after death. And I don't feel that I could tell him with an honest heart that his dad was going off to heaven. But I certainly felt confident that his dad heard every word that he said. I have no question about that in my mind. And that's, to me, the transformation that I see that near-death experiences need to make, is that we need to now start to listen to people who are dying. Let's learn from them ourselves. When you've heard, or like I have, a 7-year-old child who I asked that question of, gosh, was the experience real? And she just kind of patted me on the hand and she said, "You'll see. Heaven is fun." Do you want to come up, Raymond, and we'll take questions? Or what questions do you all have? Because I know there must be, you know, just so many questions.
In order to make it easier for you to follow along with this question and answer period, we'll repeat the questions from the audience. The first question is, if the near-death experience is so positive and joyful, why do people come back to life?
I could talk for hours on this subject, so I couldn't answer, you know, everything, but remember I told you that the patients that I studied were extraordinary. They were 1 in 1,000 to return at all. And remember I told you I didn't take volunteers in my study. You know, I went to them and said to them, tell me what it was like. Over half of the children I interviewed said they came back for a reason. And the reason always seemed to involve love of a family member. One boy said to me, Dr. Morse, this is only a week after his resuscitation, so that's why I can't really buy that retrospective fabrication theory, because this is only a week after his resuscitation. He said to me, Dr. Morse, I have a wonderful secret to tell you. I was climbing a staircase to heaven. And same, you know, staircase, but the same thing, it was a dark staircase leading towards a light. And he thought the light was heaven. I said to him, well, what happened? You know, why didn't you keep going? He said, my brother had died, and I just didn't think it would be fair to my parents if I died too. And the other kinds of reasons, you know, let's get off of the spiritual vein for a moment. I'm going to tell you, from an atheistic child, this is a child with no religious training. Dad is very, very proud that no one in his family has ever been to church, doesn't believe in God, etc. Listen to this kid's decision to return. 10 years old, nearly died of a diabetic coma. For physicians in the audience, her serum glucose was over 3,000. She had severe cerebral edema and truly was at the point of death. And I asked her, I said, you know, well, what happened? She said to me, doctors came to me. Well, you know, if every child is saying to me, I went to heaven, I sat on Jesus' lap, believe me, I would start to get a little suspicious. She said, doctors came to me. I said, oh, how did you know they're doctors? They were all dressed in white, and they had light bulbs in their bodies. And then she said, and they put a box in front of me. And they told me to press a green button and come with them. And she said, I knew I would never see my family again if I did that, so I pressed the red button instead. So she had the same experience as the 5-year-old girl that sits on Jesus' lap and says she wants to hug her mother again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, well, my work has mostly been with adults, obviously, and just as with the kids, it's always that they choose to come back for someone else. What they'll tell you is that from their own perspective, they want to stay in this state. It's so blissful. But they choose to go back. Typically, the most common reason for kids is, for adults, is that they want to go back to take care of their children. They say for themselves they would rather go on, but they chose to go back to because they had the kids left to raise.
It's extraordinary that people at the brink of death would even have the sensation that they could choose to return to life. That's extraordinary to me. Your question.
Have you ever interviewed anyone who has had a near-death experience and who had a very negative or hellish experience?
No, as a matter of fact. I would say I've talked with 2 people who had hellish kinds of experiences, but in both cases my impression was that this was a delirium, both because, number one, that was what the person's impression was. They felt that this did not manifest itself as something real, but rather as a delirious experience. The imagery was very surrealistically distorted. Also, you know, in the near-death experiences like we've been describing, it's very interesting that they seem to take place in what we call clear consciousness. The consciousness is not clouded at all. As a matter of fact, these people will say that their experience is somehow even more real than ordinary waking reality. Often the mind is clearer and so on. In the Gallup survey, it was only, as I recall, about 0.3% of the surveys in Dr. Gallup's survey in which there was a hellish kind of experience. There has been one person who has reported that there's a high percentage of the cases he's seen which were hellish in nature. But after this report came out, my friend Dr. Michael Sabom, who's a cardiologist in Atlanta who studied near-death experiences, contacted this man who had made this report, and then the man rather dramatically backed away from his claim. And for other things that happened in connection with that particular publication, I just don't trust it.
As a variation on that theme, have you ever interviewed anyone who was a murderer or had committed heinous crimes?
Well, I would say this, that I worked as a forensic psychiatrist for some time, and I have dealt with psychotic killers and serial killers and all kinds of people like that. And the two cases that do come to mind are two people that I dealt with who had near-death experiences who were, it was very plain to me from the history they gave me and from what I could find in various legal records and also from interviewing the families involved, that both of these individuals had what we call the sociopathic personality disorder, both in a very clear way, and which is incidentally one of the most intractable conditions that we deal with in psychiatry. Many people say that there's no treatment for a sociopath. These are the people like Ted Bundy and so on, who essentially have no conscience. And there's no question in my mind that in both of these cases their personalities were completely transformed and that they became very, very loving people. One of them, with whom I still talk almost weekly on the telephone, ever since his experience has been going around the country. He gives a large percentage of his income to hospices, and he's just very, very giving to other people. He sort of lives a life of service. Now, I was talking with him a few years ago, and I said, well, Dan, you know, what I really don't understand about your case is that it seems to me that you were a sociopath, and that I am very aware from my work in forensic psychiatry and talking to a lot of people and from, you know, even the definition of what this syndrome is, that sociopaths don't have a conscience, but that you very plainly do have a conscience. And his eyes at that point sort of glazed over. He sort of looked off in the distance and he says, well, no, you know, really, I still don't have a conscience. And he said, what I learned from this experience was not guilt or anything like that, but responsibility. That I saw in this review that whatever I do, I'm going to have to relive it from the other perspective. And he's now a very, very wonderfully loving person. He really is.
Can you discuss more this idea that near-death experiences are related to a certain part of the brain? How would that work?
There's an area of the brain, it's called your temporal lobe, and it's responsible for a variety of psychical and spiritual experiences. And this has been known by neuroanatomists for, for really, 50 years. Now, I can't tell you that anybody has put this material together in any kind of cohesive way, because in order to explain your question, you have to understand that most neurologists don't believe in a soul and don't believe in a sense of consciousness, but really believe that the brain is a biological machine. So nobody has really been very interested in looking at these areas, and primarily, the medical students that I've worked with and myself have sort of pulled all these articles out of the literature and tried to make sense of them ourselves. But for example, Wouter Penfield, who's the father of neurosurgery, did a number of experiments in which he took he took stainless steel needles and electrically stimulated various areas of the brain. And in the temporal lobe, when he stimulated in those areas, people had, for example, hearing heavenly music. People had the out-of-body experience. People would say, oh my God, I've left my body. People had panoramic life reviews, which they perceived as being real, in which they would say that they suddenly experienced their whole life, and such as that. Now, I want to be clear that there is not one area of the brain that is stimulated that anybody has described the full near-death experience. You know, it's not like there's a spot in the brain that suddenly they say, oh, I'm out of my body, now I'm going down a tunnel, now I'm seeing a beautiful light. It is rather that that area of the brain, when stimulated in different spots, can trigger each one of the individual features, but does not stimulate that whole cluster experience. What does this mean? Somebody asked me before the lecture, does this mean that I don't believe near-death experiences are real? Well, I guess, oddly enough, I think that that is a piece of evidence saying that near-death experiences probably are real, because after all, why would we have such an area of our brain? What evolutionary pressure could lead to us having the, oh my God, I'm leaving my body and seeing beautiful light area of the brain? You know, I think that we didn't discover that area of the brain. We just sort of resurrected an ancient literature on it. But I think that now as people start to get interested in that area of the brain, that makes it more real, at least to physicians, because when people say, oh gosh, I'm floating out of my body, it doesn't seem as real as if we can say, hey, there's an area of the brain which triggers that experience. Now, Julian Jayne is a Princeton psychologist, and he says that that same area of the brain is where ancient people perceived themselves as hearing the voices of the gods. And he had the same dilemma. He said, you know, we don't know if they were really hearing the voice of God or whether they were just sort of hearing a voice that they guess they assume was the God. So, you know, I only have more questions to your question. I certainly don't have an answer, but, there's no question in my mind that there's an area of the brain which is largely responsible for this, and psychical experiences as well. People who at least claim to be psychics, I'm not a psychic investigator, but people who claim to be psychics, when they have EEGs done on their brain, they have abnormal activity in that area. And it's also, as another fascinating little tidbit to throw into the pot, people who have multiple personality disorder, this is in the American Medical Association's neurology journal, people who claim, this is a guy, he claims he was driving down the road and there was a car accident, and as a result of that accident, he was inhabited by the souls of the people who were died in that crash. And this is reported in the American Medical Association's Archives of Neurology, so you know that's kind of reputable. And he has abnormal EEG activity in that same area of the brain. Now, you know, they of course did not take any heed to his story. They claimed he was just a multiple personality disorder and that's how he explained, you know, in some psychological way that he developed his personalities. But, you could just as easily speculate that that area of the brain is some kind of weird antenna that souls can get in. I don't know. You know, these are idle speculations. Let's face it, you know. How about right on the side?
Has studying near-death experiences changed your perspective on things? Do you feel that it's changed you as a person?
Well, I would say that it has, but not as dramatically as it changes the people who really have these experiences. I had two doctoral degrees by the time I was 30 years old, so you know that I was pretty much focused on the intellectual side of life. And it was really only after I had severe myxedema, hypothyroidism, with a TSH, for all you medical people, of 119.8 when I was finally detected. Probably had it around 20 years, they think. And I would say, it's really deeply affected me in the sense that I've gone from a person who assumed that the only channel of consciousness that was worth paying attention to, or that even existed really, was the ego-aware, reflective channel of consciousness, and who was very, very narrow in my life perspective. I've gone to a person who inwardly, as a subjective judgment, is completely confident that what we call death is just a transition into another dimension of reality, and that the most important thing we can do here is to learn how to love others. But I'm a long way from that goal, if you know what I mean. I'm not saying that I can do it, but at least it's now what I really wish I were like.
I'm just going to briefly tell you that it's really, I'm a practicing pediatrician. I saw 33 patients in my office this morning before getting on a plane to come down and see you all. I've got three kids. I live on 15 acres with a horse farm, so I just don't have a lot of time for a lot of spiritual musings. The thing, my book is not really a religious book. I don't really discuss spiritual issues in my book. For a subject that is innately spiritual as this, the way it's affected me is that I started learning something about my fellow physicians and doctors in hospitals when I did this study. I learned that this is really threatening stuff. Just the simple statement that, hey, people have amazing spiritual experiences when they die, you wouldn't believe how threatening that is to people. I've had people come up to me and say, well, what are you going to believe in faith healing next? And, one thing that's changed me is now I guess I'm open. Maybe there is something in faith healing. That's certainly not a statement I would have made 5 years ago. But I also thought that weird dichotomy that you either have to believe in a sort of reductionistic, mechanical view of life, or you have to, be sort of, totally immersed in, in believing in the spiritual. And I think that's an unhealthy situation which is currently infecting our society. I don't see why we can't do both. Why we can't recognize that we are kind of shamefully poor at helping people to die, and we kind of ignore all of these sorts of spiritual experiences or just dismiss them as hallucinations, whereas a clinician, they have incredible comfort. I mean, even if I didn't believe in near-death experiences, I would think that it would be the right thing to at least pretend you believe in them, just because of the incredible comfort, and yet most people don't. You would be surprised how many parents say to me, a lot of children have said to me, well, I tried to tell my doctor about it, and she just laughed. Well, I tried to tell my doctor about it, and he said, oh, that was just because of the drugs we were taking. Even, this is best in the movie Flatliners. If you've all seen that movie, I love that movie because even the open medical student who wants to learn about these experiences, she goes to the ward, she interviews them, and she hears the experience, and what's her first reaction? She says, I think we better adjust your medications. And that's what's more interesting to me, is I think I've learned an awful lot that I was completely unaware of before about how we treat death and dying and how we even react to these. Even that I'm so leery of using a word like love in discussing these experiences, I think I've learned a lot from that. How about way in the back there?
In some ancient cultures, isn't there an emphasis on becoming familiar with altered states and even training people for the experience of dying?
Very true. You know, the ancient Greeks even had institutions to give people these transformative experiences. They had a place called the Oracle of the Dead on the Acheron River at a place called Apara, where if you were having a difficulty with death, that you needed to make peace with death, you would go to this place, and there you would go through various preparations, but then in the ceremony you were taken into an underground labyrinthine chamber, and you were down there for 29 days, and the only people you would have to have contact with would be the priests who would come down there to minister to you. And then on the 29th day, you were conducted into this one chamber where the expectation would be that you would have a visionary experience, which would, in fact, give you peace about death. And they would have, in these experiences, they would actually feel that they were in touch with relatives or friends of theirs who were already dead on the other side. And then after this tremendously powerful experience, they were brought out into the light of the day, and they were led down to the Acheron to have a ritual bath. And this Oracle of the Dead is apparently what Plato was alluding to in the myth of the cave.
Are people familiar with the myth of the cave by Plato? I got to tell you all this story. You should probably tell it, because he's a professor of philosophy. Because I think it's so pertinent to the near-death experience. Here's what Plato said that life is like. Life is like we're all sitting in a cave under the ground, but we're all chained in such a way that we can't see each other. We're all chained in a circle facing out from the circle. And then in the center of the circle is a fire, so that all we can see are the shadows projected by the fire of our own bodies against the wall. Then he says that naturally enough, people look at those shadows and assume that those shadows are their real being, because that's all they can see, is all they can see is these shadows on the wall. And then he says, what if someone was to get loose of those chains? And then it's amazing, he actually says it's a tunnel. And he says, suppose that person crawled up that tunnel to the world. He said the first thing that would happen is that person would be struck by a blinding light, so bright that they couldn't see anything. Because, if you've ever been in a movie theater and then you go into the light, all of a sudden you can't see anything. And he said, what would happen then if that person, after seeing that light and recognizing, that they've been living this life of shadows, what if that person went down to the cave and then told those people, said, hey, wait a minute, you guys, those shadows aren't really real, you guys are really chained in a circle around the fire. He says, do you think those people would then unchain themselves and rush up to the light? He would say, no, that person would be ridiculed and laughed at and said, what, are you crazy? There's some other world up there down a tunnel. And in a way, I love that story, because he's really describing what happens to people who've had the near-death experience. Virtually all the patients I've talked to are afraid and ashamed to talk about it. They really think that people will think they're crazy if they talk about this experience. And it's funny that you bring that up, because I think that Plato, I think he's absolutely right. That people who've had visionary experiences, we just assume that they're crazy. And particularly in our society, that's that little girl I told you about, I didn't know you could talk to God. And I think that what she's saying is, hey, people who talk to God are homeless people on the street. You can go to a church like this and hear people talk about God, but if I was on this lecture saying to you, oh, by the way, God told me that near-death experiences are real, I bet most of the people would walk out, right? Well, God didn't tell me that, by the way. I haven't had conversations with God, but, I think, those who perceive they have are in a very tenuous situation in our society.
And we just got the signal that it's time.
This concludes Near-Death Experiences with Dr. Raymond Moody and Dr. Melvin Morse. If you would like additional copies of this recording, or to receive a complete catalog of transformational audio tapes, please call Sounds True, 303-449-6229, or write 735 Walnut Street, Boulder, Colorado, 80302.